only of the performance. His admiration was certainly very warm, yet she thought but for Mrs. Weston it would not have struck her. She turned to another subject of her curiosity.
The present from the Campbells, this pianoforte, is very kindly given.
Yes, but they would have done better had they given her notice of it. Surprises are foolish things. The pleasure is not enhanced, and the inconvenience is often considerable. I should have expected better judgment in Colonel Campbell.
From that moment, Emma could have taken her oath that Mr. Knightley had had no concern in giving the instrument. But whether he were entirely free from peculiar attachment, whether there were no actual preference, remained a little longer doubtful. Within 5 minutes of the singing being over, the proposal of dancing, originating nobody exactly knew where, was so effectually promoted by Mr. and Mrs. Cole that everything was rapidly clearing away to give proper space. Mrs. Weston, capital in playing country dances, was seated at the instrument and beginning an irresistible waltz, and Frank Churchill, coming up with most becoming gallantry to Emma, had secured her hand and led her up to the top. While waiting till the other young people could pair themselves off, Emma looked about to see what became of Mr. Knightley. This would be a trial. He was no dancer, in general. If he were to be very alert in engaging Jane Fairfax now, it might augur something. No, he was talking to Mrs. Cole. He was looking on unconcerned, and Jane was asked by somebody else. Emma had no longer any alarm of an attachment, and she led off the dance with genuine spirit and enjoyment. Not more than 5 couples could be mustered, but the rarity and suddenness of it made it very delightful, and she found herself well matched in a partner. They were a couple worth looking at. 2 dances, unfortunately, were all that could be allowed. It was growing late, and Miss Bates became anxious to get home on her mother's account. The guests were obliged to thank Mrs. Cole, therefore, look sorrowful, and have done. Emma did not repent her condescension in going to the Coles. The visit afforded her many pleasant recollections the next day, and all that she might be supposed to have lost on the side of dignified seclusion must be amply repaid in the splendour of popularity. She must have delighted the Coles, worthy people, who deserved to be made happy, and left a name behind her that would not soon die away. Perfect happiness, however, even in memory, is not common. She doubted whether she had not transgressed the duty of woman by woman in betraying her suspicions of Jane Fairfax's feelings to Frank Churchill. It was hardly right, but it had been so strong an idea that it would escape her, and his submission to all that she told made it difficult for her to be quite certain that she ought to have held her tongue. She was then interrupted by Harriet's coming in and talking excitedly of the whole evening for a good few minutes together. On one topic, however, she was more hesitant.
And how did you think the Coxes looked, Miss Woodhouse?
Just as they always do. Very vulgar.
They told me something, but it is nothing of any consequence.
And what was it?
They told me that Mr. Martin dined with them last Saturday.
Oh.
He came to their father upon some business, and he asked him to stay to dinner. They talked a great deal about him, especially Anne Cox. I do not know what she meant, but she asked me if I thought I should go and stay with the Martins again next summer.
She meant to be impertinently curious, just as such an Anne Cox will be.
She said Mr. Martin was very agreeable the day he dined there. He sat by her at dinner. Miss Nash thinks either of the Coxes would be very glad to marry him.
Very likely. I think they are, without exception, the most vulgar girls in Highbury.
Harriet had business at Ford's. Emma thought it most prudent to go with her. Another accidental meeting with the Martins was possible, and, in her present state, would be dangerous. Harriet, tempted by everything and swayed by half a word, was always very long at a purchase, and while she was still hanging over muslins and changing her mind, Emma went to the door for amusement. In looking down the Randalls Road, she saw 2 familiar persons appear, Mrs. Weston and her son-in-law. They were walking into Highbury, to Hartfield, of course. They were stopping, however, in the first place at Mrs. Bates's, whose house was a little nearer Randall's than Ford's, and had all but knocked when Emma caught their eye. Immediately, they crossed the road and came forward to her. They spoke of all the pleasures of yesterday's engagement, all three united in their opinion of it. Mrs. Weston informed Emma that she was going to call on the Bateses in order to hear the new instrument.
My companion tells me that I absolutely promised Miss Bates last night that I would come this morning. I was not aware of it myself. I did not know that I had fixed a day. But, as he says I did, I am going now.
Will you join us, Miss Woodhouse? The Bateses are always delighted to see you.
I thank you, but I am only waiting for my friend. She will probably have soon done, and then we shall go home.
Such a pity. They shall miss your opinion on the pianoforte, and we shall miss your company.
Do join us, Emma. We shall not be long, and we can return to Hartfield together later.
Very well. I shall follow in a few moments when we have finished our business.
Emma joined Harriet at the counter, trying with all the force of her own mind to convince her that if she wanted plain muslin, it was of no use to look at figured, and that a blue ribbon, be it ever so beautiful, would still never match her yellow pattern. At last it was all settled, and they walked the short distance to the Bates's apartment. The appearance of the little sitting room as they entered was tranquillity itself. Mrs. Bates was slumbering on one side of the fire, Frank Churchill, at a table near her, most deedily occupied about fixing her spectacles, and Jane Fairfax standing with her back to them, intent on her pianoforte. Busy as Frank was, however, the young man was yet able to show a most happy countenance on seeing Emma again. He contrived that she should be seated by him, and was sufficiently employed in looking out the best baked apple for her and asking her advice in his work, till Jane Fairfax was quite ready to sit down to the pianoforte again. Emma thought her nervous. She had not yet possessed the instrument long enough to touch it without emotion. She must reason herself into the power of performance. Emma could not but pity such feelings, whatever their origin, and resolved never to expose them to her neighbour again. At last Jane began, and though the first bars were feebly given, the powers of the instrument were gradually done full justice to. Frank Churchill looked up from his fixing of Mrs. Bates's spectacles to tease Miss Fairfax quite openly.
How much your friends in Ireland must be enjoying your pleasure on this occasion, Miss Fairfax. I dare say they often think of you and wonder which will be the day, the precise day of the instrument's coming to hand. Do you imagine Colonel Campbell knows the business to be going forward just at this time? Or do you imagine that he may have sent only a general direction, an order indefinite as to time to depend on contingencies and conveniences?
Till I have a letter from Colonel Campbell, I can imagine nothing with any confidence. It must all be conjecture.
Conjecture, aye. Sometimes one conjectures right, and sometimes one conjectures wrong. I wish I could conjecture how soon I shall make this rivet quite firm. What nonsense one talks, Miss Woodhouse, when hard at work, if one talks at all. Your real workmen, I suppose, hold their tongues, but we gentlemen labourers... There, it is done. Miss Fairfax, might I look at your new collection of music?
Jane consented, and Frank stepped over to take up the sheet music beside her. Emma saw Jane's eyes dart away from his and thought that the attention could only be adding to her nerves.
Well, here is something quite new to me. Do you know it? Kramer. And here are a new set of Irish melodies. That, from such a quarter, one might expect. This was all sent with the instrument. Very thoughtful of Colonel Campbell, was not it? He knew Miss Fairfax could have no music here. I honour that part of the attention particularly. It shows it to have been so thoroughly from the heart. Nothing hastily done, nothing incomplete. True affection only could have prompted it. Miss Fairfax, will you be so good as to play another song? If you are very kind, it will be one of the waltzes we danced last night. Let me live them over again.
I shall attempt it, but I cannot recreate last night, for only Mrs. Weston plays so well for dancing.
Nonsense. Please do play a waltz, Miss Fairfax. I am sure you will do it beautifully.
She played, and upon her conclusion of the piece was roundly praised. When Frank proclaimed it was a waltz that had been danced at Weymouth, she looked up at him for a moment, then coloured deeply and played something else. and yet the blush was followed by a smile of secret delight. This amiable, upright, perfect Jane Fairfax was apparently cherishing very reprehensible feelings. Emma wished he would be less pointed in trying to uncover her feelings for Mr. Dixon. Frank brought all the music to her, and they looked it over together. Emma took the opportunity of whispering to him.
You speak too plain. She must understand you.
I hope she does. I am not in the least ashamed of my meaning.
But really, I am half ashamed and wish I had never taken up the idea.
I am very glad you did and that you communicated it to me. I have now a key to all her odd looks and ways. Leave shame to her. If she does wrong, she ought to feel it.
She is not entirely without it, I think.
I do not see much sign of it. She is playing Robin Adair at this moment, his favorite. See how Miss Bates hovers by her at the window, as if to protect her niece.
Oh! You play so well, Jane.
Beautifully played.
Upon my honour. Oh, look, Mr. Knightley is passing by, I declare. I must speak to him if possible, just to thank him. Will you forgive me if I open the window for just a moment? I dare say he will come in when he knows who is here. Mr. Knightley! Mr. Knightley, how do you do? How do you do? So obliged to you for the carriage last night. We were just in time. My mother just ready for us. Pray come in. Do come in. You will find some friends here.
How is your niece, Miss Bates? I want to inquire after you all, but particularly your niece. How is Miss Fairfax? I hope she caught no cold last night. How is she today?
Very well. She is very well, I thank you. No sign of a cold, not one. We are so obliged to you. So very much obliged to you for the carriage.
I'm going to Kingston. Can I do anything for you?
Oh, dear Kingston, are you? Mrs. Cole was saying the other day she wanted something from Kingston.
Well, Mrs. Cole has servants to send. Can I do anything for you?
No, I thank you, but do come in. Who do you think is here? Miss Woodhouse and Miss Smith, so kind as to call to hear the new pianoforte. Do put up your horse at the Crown and come in.
Well, for 5 minutes, perhaps.
And here is Mrs. Weston and Mr. Frank Churchill, too. Quite delightful. So many friends.
No, actually, forgive me. I could not stay 2 minutes. I must get on to Kingston as fast as I can.
Oh, do come in. They'll be so very happy to see you.
No. Your room is full enough. I'll call another day and hear your pianoforte.
Well, I am so sorry. Oh, Mr. Knightley, what a delightful party last night. How extremely pleasant. Did you ever see such dancing? Was it not delightful? Miss Woodhouse and Mr. Frank Churchill. I never saw anything equal to it.
Oh, very delightful indeed. I can say nothing less, for I suppose Miss Woodhouse and Mr. Frank Churchill are hearing everything that passes. And I do not see why Miss Fairfax should not be mentioned too. I think Miss Fairfax dances very well. And Mrs. Weston is the very best country dance player without exception in England. Now, if your friends have any gratitude, they will say something pretty loud about you and me in return, but I cannot stay to hear it.
Mr. Knightley, one moment more. Something of consequence. So shocked. Jane and I are both so shocked about the apples.
How can apples be shocking, Miss Bates?
To think of your sending us all your store apples.
Do not think of it, madam.
You said you had a great many, and now you have not one left. We really are so shocked. You should not have done it. Indeed, you should not...
Goodbye, Miss Bates.
Goodbye, Mr. Knightley. Oh, well, I have not been able to succeed. Mr. Knightley cannot stop. He never can bear to be thanked. He's going to Kingston. He asked me if he could do anything.
Yes, we heard his kind offers. We heard everything.
Oh, yes, my dear. I dare say you might. Because, you know, the window was open and Mr. Knightley spoke loud. He must have heard everything to be sure. Oh, Miss Woodhouse, must you be going? You seem but just come. So very obliging of you.
It was delightful to see you, Miss Bates, but I'm afraid we must return to Hartfield.
Harriet stood with Emma, and upon examining watches, Mrs. Weston and Frank Churchill found they must also take their leave. The visit had been longer than expected, and the lateness of the morning obliged the party to divide at Hartfield. The following evening took Emma to Randall's once more, and Mr. Woodhouse had been persuaded to join his daughter. The last half hour of the evening was passed in discussion of dancing and a most ardent wish from most quarters to arrange a ball. Frank Churchill had danced once at Highbury and longed to dance again. It may be possible to do without dancing entirely. Instances have been known of young people passing many months successively without being at any ball and no material injury accruing either to mind or body. But when a beginning is made, when the felicities of rapid motion have once been, though slightly felt, it must be a very heavy set that does not ask for more. Frank's was the first idea. His proposition and request that the dance begun at Mr. Cole's should be finished there, that the same party should be collected and the same musician engaged, met with the readiest acquiescence. Mr. Weston entered into the idea with thorough enjoyment, and Mrs. Weston most willingly undertook to play as long as they could wish to dance. The interesting employment had followed of reckoning up exactly who there would be and portioning out the division of space to every couple. When all were counted, all the invitations that must reasonably be sent, it was concluded there would be 10 couples. Dancing again at the Coles with so many would not do. Nothing can be farther from pleasure than to be dancing in a crowd, and a crowd in a little room. The suggestion was made of using 2 rooms at the Coles, connected by a short passage, but the evils of the draught to be found there were too much for Mr. Woodhouse to give his consent. Randall's was then discussed, but found to be equally wanting in rooms that could comfortably accommodate so many. Frank graciously agreed with all arguments against the scheme at Randall's, then promptly argued in favour once more. Emma perceived that the nature of his gallantry was a little self-willed. Had she intended ever to marry him, it might have been worthwhile to consider what it signified as to the character of his temper. But for all the purposes of their acquaintance, he was quite amiable enough. Before the middle of the next day, he was at Hartfield, and he entered the room with such an agreeable smile as certified the continuance of the scheme. It soon appeared that he came to announce an improvement.
Good morning, Mr. Woodhouse.
Good day to you, Mr. Churchill.
And good morning, Miss Woodhouse. Your inclination for dancing has not been quite frightened away, I hope. I bring a new proposal on the subject, a thought of my father's, which waits only on your approbation to be acted upon. May I hope for the honour of your hand for the 2 first dances of this little projected ball, to be given not at Randall's, but at the Crown Inn.
The Crown?
Yes. If you and Mr. Woodhouse see no objection, my father hopes his friends will be so kind as to visit him there. He can promise them better accommodations and not a less grateful welcome than at Randall's. It is his own idea, and Mrs. Weston sees no objection to it, provided you are satisfied. This is what we all feel. You were perfectly right. 10 couples in either of the Randall's rooms would have been insufferable, dreadful. I felt how right you were the whole time, but was too anxious for securing anything to like to yield. Is not it a good exchange? You consent. I hope you consent.
It appears to me a plan that nobody can object to, if Mr. and Mrs. Weston do not. I think it admirable, and as far as I can answer for myself, shall be most happy. It seems the only improvement that could be. Papa, do you not think it an excellent improvement?
No, indeed. I think it very far from an improvement, a very bad plan, much worse than the other. A room at an inn is always damp and dangerous, never properly aired or fit to be inhabited. You shall catch worse colds at the Crown than anywhere.
I was going to observe, sir, that one of the greatest recommendations of this change would be the very little danger of anybody's catching cold, much less danger at the Crown than at Randall's, since the room is so much larger. We shall have no occasion to open the windows at all, not once, the whole evening. And it is that dreadful habit of opening the windows, letting in cold air upon heated bodies, which, as you well know, sir, does the mischief.
Open the windows? But surely, Mr. Churchill, nobody could be so imprudent. I never heard of such a thing. Dancing with open window?
Ah, sir, I am afraid a thoughtless young person will sometimes step behind a window curtain and throw up a sash without its being suspected. I have often known it done myself.
Have you indeed, sir? Bless me. I could never have supposed it. But I live out of the world and am often astonished at what I hear. However, this does make a difference. And perhaps if Mr. and Mrs. Weston will be so obliging as to call here one morning, we may talk it over and see what can be done.
I can reassure you on that front, sir. It will all be under Mrs. Weston's care. She undertakes to direct the whole.
There, Papa. Now you must be satisfied. Our own dear Mrs. Weston, who is carefulness itself.
My father and Mrs. Weston are at the Crown at this moment, examining the capabilities of the house. I left them there and came on to Hartfield, impatient for the opinion of Miss Woodhouse, and hoping she might be persuaded to join them and give her advice on the spot. I was desired to say so from both. It would be the greatest pleasure to them. Sir, would you allow me to attend Miss Woodhouse there?
Emma was most happy to be called to such a council, and her father, engaging to think it all over while she was gone, the two young people set off together without delay for the Crown. There were Mr. and Mrs. Weston, delighted to see her and receive her approbation, very busy and very happy in their different way. She in some little distress over the state of the paper and the rather forlorn wainscot, and he finding everything perfect. The ladies here probably exchanged looks, which meant men never know when things are dirty or not, and the gentlemen perhaps thought each to himself, women will have their little nonsenses and needless cares. For another half hour they were all walking to and fro between the different rooms, some suggesting, some attending, and all in happy enjoyment of the future. The party did not break up without Emma's being positively secured for the two first dances by the hero of the evening, nor without her overhearing Mr. Weston whisper to his wife, "He has asked her, my dear. I knew he would." One thing only was wanting to make the prospect of the ball completely satisfactory to Emma. Enscombe must grant Frank Churchill a longer stay in Surrey in order to attend. For a few days they must be planning, proceeding and hoping in uncertainty, at the risk of its being all in vain. Enscombe, however, was gracious. Gracious in fact, if not in word. His wish of staying longer evidently did not please, but it was not opposed. All was safe and prosperous. 2 days of such joyful security, however, were immediately followed by the overthrow of everything. A letter arrived at Hartfield during breakfast from Mrs. Weston to convey the wretched news.
Oh, this is just what I feared.
What is it, my dear?
There shall be no ball, Papa. Frank Churchill is to return home at the orders of Mrs. Churchill. Mrs. Weston has written to tell me so. Mrs. Churchill is unwell, far too unwell to do without him.
Mrs. Churchill is ill? I'm sorry to hear it. Is it sudden? Is it serious?
Mr. Churchill says she has been in a very suffering state from writing to her nephew 2 days before, though from her constant habit of never thinking of herself, she had not mentioned it. But now she is too ill to trifle and must entreat him to set off at Enscombe without delay.
Oh, I wish she had Mr. Perry at her disposal. I suppose her nephew has left already.
He is planning to call here after breakfast, apparently.
Emma read the remainder of the letter to herself, though without feeling any real alarm for Mrs. Churchill. He must be gone within a few hours. He knew her illnesses. They never occurred but for her own convenience. When once it had been read, there was no doing anything but lament and exclaim. The loss of the ball, the loss of the young man, and all that the young man might be feeling. It was too wretched. Such a delightful evening as it would have been, everybody so happy, and she and her partner the happiest. Emma was ready for her visitor some time before he appeared, with a sorrowful look and total want of spirits. He felt the going away almost too much to speak of it. His dejection was most evident. He sat really lost in thought for the first few minutes, and when rousing himself, it was not with the eloquence that such time may have provided were he not so burdened with regrets.
Of all horrid things, leave-taking is the worst.
But you will come again. This will not be your only visit to Randall's.
Ah, the uncertainty of when I may be able to return. I shall try for it with a zeal. It will be the object of all my thoughts and cares. If my uncle and aunt go to town this spring, but I am afraid they did not stir last spring, I am afraid it is a custom gone forever.
Our poor ball must be quite given up.
Oh, that ball. Why did we wait for anything? Why not seize the pleasure at once? How often is happiness destroyed by preparation, foolish preparation? You told us it would be so. Oh, Miss Woodhouse, why are you always so right?
Indeed, I am very sorry to be right in this instance. I would much rather have been merry than wise.
If I can come again, we are still to have our ball. My father depends on it. Do not forget your engagement. Such a fortnight as it has been. Every day more precious and more delightful than the day before. Every day making me less fit to bear any other place. Happy are those who can remain at Highbury.
As you do us such ample justice now, I will venture to ask whether you did not come a little doubtfully at first. Do not we rather surpass your expectations? I am sure we do. I am sure you did not much expect to like us. You would not have been so long in coming if you had had a pleasant idea of Highbury.
Ha! No, indeed, that is nowhere near the truth of it.
And you must be off this very morning?
Yes. My father is to join me here. We shall walk back together, and I must be off immediately. I'm afraid that every moment will bring him.
Not 5 minutes to spare even for your friends Miss Fairfax and Miss Bates. How unlucky. Miss Bates's powerful, argumentative mind might have strengthened yours.
Yes, I have called there. Passing the door, I thought it better. It was the right thing to do. I went in for 3 minutes and was detained by Miss Bates's being absent. She was out, and I felt it impossible not to wait till she came in. She is a woman that one may, that one must laugh at, but that one would not wish to slight. It was better to pay my visit then. In short, perhaps, Miss Woodhouse, I think you can hardly be quite without suspicion.
You are quite in the right. It was most natural to pay your visit this morning.
He was silent, probably reflecting on what she had said and trying to understand the manner. She heard him sigh. It was natural for him to feel that he had cause to sigh. He could not believe her to be encouraging him. A few awkward moments passed, and when he spoke again, it was in a more determined manner.
It was something to feel that all the rest of my time might be given to Hartfield. My regard for Hartfield is most warm.
He stopped again and seemed quite embarrassed. He was more in love with her than Emma had supposed, and who can say how it might have ended if his father had not made his appearance? Mr. Woodhouse soon followed, and the necessity of exertion made him composed. Mr. Weston, always alert when business was to be done, and incapable of procrastinating any evil that was inevitable, insisted that it was time to go. Frank's parting remarks were addressed to the room, but his eyes, it seemed, marked out Emma from the rest.
I shall hear about you all. That is my chief consolation. I shall hear of everything that is going on among you. I have engaged Mrs. Weston to correspond with me, and she has been so kind as to promise it. Oh, the blessings of a female correspondent when one is really interested in the absent. She will tell me everything. In her letters, I shall be at dear Highbury again. I cannot thank you enough for the kindness every day bestowed upon me by Hartfield. Goodbye, Mr. Woodhouse.
Take care on the road, Mr. Churchill.
I shall. Goodbye, Miss Woodhouse.
Goodbye, Mr. Churchill.
The door soon shut out Frank Churchill. Short had been the notice, short their meeting. He was gone. And Emma felt so sorry to part, and foresaw so great a loss to their little society from his absence, as to begin to be afraid of being too sorry and feeling it too much. It was a sad change. It had been a very happy fortnight, and forlorn must be the sinking from it into the common course of Hartfield days. To complete every other recommendation, he had almost told her that he loved her. What strength or what constancy of affection he might be subject to was another point, but at present she could not doubt his having a decidedly warm admiration for her. This persuasion, joined to all the rest, made her think that she must be a little in love with him in spite of every previous determination against it. "I certainly must," said she. This sensation of listlessness, weariness, stupidity, this disinclination to sit down and employ myself, this feeling of everything's being dull and insipid about the house, I must be in love. I should be the oddest creature in the world if I were not. For a few weeks, at least. It was some days before she saw Jane Fairfax, to judge of her honest regret in this woeful change, but when they did meet, her composure was odious. She had been suffering from headache, however, and it was charity to impute some of her unbecoming indifference to the languor of ill health. Emma soon was busy and cheerful again, and pleasing as Frank Churchill was, she could yet imagine him to have faults. And father, though thinking of him so much and fancying interesting dialogues and inventing elegant letters, the conclusion of every imaginary declaration on his side was that she refused him. Their affection was always to subside into friendship. When she became sensible of this, it struck her that she could not be very much in love, for in spite of her previous and fixed determination never to quit her father, never to marry, a strong attachment certainly must produce more of a struggle than she could foresee in her own feelings. I do suspect that he is not really necessary to my happiness. So much the better. I shall do very well again after a little while, and then it will be a good thing over, for they say everybody is in love once in their lives, and I shall have been let off easily. When his letter to Mrs. Weston arrived, Emma had the perusal of it. It was a long, well-written letter, displaying real feeling towards Mrs. Weston and the transition from Highbury to Enscombe. The contrast between the places was just enough touched on to show how keenly it was felt, and how much more might have been said but for the restraints of propriety. The charm of her own name was not wanting. Miss Woodhouse appeared more than once, and never without a something of pleasing connection, either a compliment to her taste or a remembrance of what she had said. Compressed into the very lowest vacant corner were these words. "I had not a spare moment on Tuesday, as you know, for Miss Woodhouse's beautiful little friend. Pray make my excuses and adieus to her." His information and prospects as to Enscombe were neither worse nor better than had been anticipated. Mrs. Churchill was recovering, and he dared not yet, even in his own imagination, fix a time for coming to Randalls again. Gratifying as was the letter in the material part, however, its sentiments had not added any lasting warmth. Emma found that she could still do without the writer, and that he must learn to do without her. Her intentions were unchanged, but a fresh scheme formed for his subsequent happiness. His recollection of Harriet and the words which clothed it, the beautiful little friend, suggested to her the idea of Harriet's succeeding her in his affections. Was it impossible? No. Harriet undoubtedly was greatly his inferior in understanding, but he had been very much struck with the loveliness of her face and the warm simplicity of her manner. For Harriet, it would be advantageous and delightful indeed. "I must not dwell upon it," thought Emma. "I know the danger of indulging such speculations, but stranger things have happened." Immediately upon Frank Churchill's disappearance, the conversation of Highbury turned once more to Mr. Elton. His wedding day was named, and he would soon be among them again. Mr. Elton and his bride! Emma grew sick at the sound. She had had 3 weeks of happy exemption from Mr. Elton, and Harriet's mind, she had been willing to hope, had been lately gaining strength, but the news had left poor Harriet in a flutter of spirits. She required all the reasonings and soothings and attentions of every kind that Emma could give, but it was heavy work to be forever convincing without producing any effect, and the next half hour saw her as anxious and restless about the Eltons as before. At last, Emma attacked her on another ground.
Dear Harriet, think of it in this regard. You're allowing yourself to be so occupied and so unhappy about Mr. Elton's marrying is the strongest reproach you can make me. You could not give me a greater reproof for the mistake I fell into. It was all my doing, I know. I have not forgotten it, I assure you. Deceived myself, I did very miserably deceive you, and it will be a painful reflection to me forever.
Dear Miss Woodhouse, I could never wish to cause you a moment's pain. I hope I have not. I could not bear it.
I have not asked that you think less, talk less of Mr. Elton for my sake, because it is for your own sake, rather, I would wish it to be done. To form a habit of self-command in you, a consideration of what is your duty, an attention to propriety, an endeavour to avoid the suspicions of others, to save your health and credit, and restore your tranquillity. These are the motives which I have been pressing on you. They are very important, and sorry I am that you cannot feel them sufficiently to act upon them. My being saved from pain is a very secondary consideration. I want you to save yourself from greater pain. Perhaps I may sometimes have felt that you would not forget what was due, or rather what would be kind by me.
You, who have been the best friend I have ever had in my life, nobody is equal to you. I care for nobody as I do for you. Oh, Miss Woodhouse, how ungrateful I have been.
There is no charm equal to tenderness of heart, said Emma afterwards to herself. It is tenderness of heart which makes my dear father so generally beloved, which gives Isabella all her popularity. I have it not, but I know how to prize and respect it. Harriet is my superior in all the charm and all the felicity it gives. Happy the man who changes Emma for Harriet. Mrs. Elton was first seen at church, but curiosity could not be satisfied by a bride in a pew, and it must be left for the visits in form, which were then to be paid, to settle whether she were very pretty indeed, or only rather pretty, or not pretty at all. Emma had feelings less of curiosity than of pride or propriety to make her resolve on not being the last to pay her respects, and she made a point of Harriet's going with her, that the worst of the business might be gone through as soon as possible. She could not enter the house, to which she had with such vain artifice retreated 3 months ago to lace up her boot without recollecting. A thousand vexatious thoughts would recur, compliments, charades, and horrible blunders, and it was not to be supposed that poor Harriet should not be recollecting too. But she behaved very well, and she was only rather pale and silent. The visit was, of course, short, and there was so much embarrassment and occupation of mind to shorten it still more.
You do not want for tea, I suppose?
No, I thank you. We can only afford a brief visit. Well, we must not detain you further, but it was such a pleasure to meet you, Mrs. Elton.
Thank
Thank you, Miss Woodhouse. I feel quite settled in Highbury already.
Do you indeed? I am glad to hear it.
It is a skill of mine, I dare say, that where my heart is attached, there is home. It is quite instant in its effect.
What pleasure and comfort that must bring.
I regard it as the most noble form of self-sufficiency, and but one of Augusta's many virtues.
Nonsense! You do flatter me so, Mr. Elton.
You will excuse us. We really must be on our way.
Of course. Thank you for your kind visit, Miss Woodhouse. Miss Smith?
After such a short visit, Emma would not allow herself entirely to form an opinion of the lady, but she did not really like her. She suspected that there was no elegance. Ease, but not elegance. She was almost sure that for a young woman, a stranger, a bride, there was too much ease. Her person was rather good, her face not unpretty. But neither feature nor air nor voice nor manner were elegant. Emma thought at least it would turn out so. As for Mr. Elton, his manners did not appear... But no, she would not permit a hasty or a witty word from herself about his manners. It was an awkward ceremony at any time to be receiving wedding visits, and when she considered how peculiarly unlucky poor Mr. Elton was in being in the same room at once with the woman he'd just married, the woman he had wanted to marry, and the woman whom he had been expected to marry, she must allow him to look as little wise and to be as uneasy as could be. When they had quitted the house and walked a little way off, it was Harriet who first spoke of the meeting.
Well, Miss Woodhouse, what do you think of her? Is not she very charming?
Oh, yes, very...
a very pleasing young woman. I think her beautiful, quite beautiful. I'm not at all surprised that he should have fallen in love.
No, no, there is nothing to surprise one at all. A pretty fortune, and she came in his way.
I dare say she was very much attached to him.
Perhaps... But it is not every man's fate to marry the woman who loves him best. Miss Hawkins perhaps wanted a home, and thought this the best offer she was likely to have.
Yes, and well she might. Nobody could ever have a better. Well, I wish them happy with all my heart. And now, Miss Woodhouse, I do not think I shall mind seeing them again. He is just as superior as ever, but being married, you know, it is quite a different thing. No, indeed, Miss Woodhouse, you need not be afraid. I can sit and admire him now without any great misery. She does seem a charming young woman, just what he deserves. Happy creature. He called her Augusta. How delightful.
When the visit was returned, Emma made up her mind. She could then see more and judge better. From Harriet's happening not to be at Hartfield, and her father's being present to engage Mr. Elton, she had a quarter of an hour of the lady's conversation to herself, which quite convinced her that Mrs. Elton was a vain woman, extremely well satisfied with herself, that she meant to shine and be very superior, but with pert and familiar manners, with foolish, even ignorant notions gained from only one set of people. Her society would certainly do Mr. Elton no good. Harriet would have been a better match. If not wise or refined herself, she would have connected him with those who were, but Miss Hawkins, it might be fairly supposed from her easy conceit, had been the best of her own set. The rich brother-in-law near Bristol was the pride of the alliance, and his place and his carriages were the pride of him. It naturally followed that he was the very first subject after being seated.
I am so very struck, Miss Woodhouse, at just how alike Hartfield is to Maple Grove. My brother, Mr. Suckling's seat. I assure you, Miss Woodhouse, it is very delightful to me to be so reminded of a place I am so extremely partial to as Maple Grove. Whenever you are transplanted, like me, Miss Woodhouse, you will understand how very delightful it is to meet with anything at all like what one has left behind. And it is not merely the house, the grounds, I assure you, as far as I could observe, are strikingly like. The laurels at Maple Grove are in the same profusion as here and stand very much in the same way, just across the lawn. My brother and sister will be enchanted with this place.
People who have extensive grounds themselves are always pleased with anything in the same style. My brother and sister have promised us a visit in the spring or summer at farthest, and that will be our time for exploring. While they are with us, we shall explore a great deal, I dare say. They will have their barouche landau, of course, which holds four perfectly and will let them see as much as possible of this beautiful country. You have many parties of that kind here, I suppose, Miss Woodhouse, every summer?
No, not immediately here. We are rather out of distance of the very striking beauties which attract the sort of parties you speak of. And we are a very quiet set of people, I believe. More disposed to stay at home than engage in schemes of pleasure.
There is nothing like staying at home for real comfort. Nobody can be more devoted to home than I am. I was quite a proverb for it at Maple Grove. And I perfectly understand your situation here, Miss Woodhouse. Your father's state of health must be a great drawback. Why does he not try Bath? Indeed, he should. Let me recommend Bath to you. I assure you, I have no doubt of its doing Mr. Woodhouse good.
My father tried it more than once formally, but without receiving any benefit.
Ah, that's a great pity. For I assure you, Miss Woodhouse, where the waters do agree, it is quite wonderful the relief they give. In my Bath life, I have seen such instances of it. And a little time there would be a charming introduction for you, who have lived so secluded a life. And I could immediately secure you some of the best society in the place. A line from me would bring you a little host of acquaintance, and my particular friend, Mrs. Partridge, the lady I have always resided with when in Bath, would be most happy to show you any attentions, and would be the very person for you to go into public with.
It was as much as Emma could bear without being impolite. The idea of her being indebted to Mrs. Elton for what was called an introduction, of her going into public under the auspices of a friend of Mrs. Elton's, probably some vulgar, dashing widow who, with the help of a boarder, just made a shift to live. The dignity of Miss Woodhouse of Hartfield was sunk indeed. She restrained herself, however, from any of the reproofs she could have given, and only thanked Mrs. Elton coolly. But their going to Bath was quite out of the question. And then, to prevent farther outrage and indignation, changed the subject directly.
I do not ask whether you are musical, Mrs. Elton. Upon these occasions, a lady's character generally precedes her, and Highbury has long known that you are a superior performer.
Oh, no, indeed. I must protest against any such idea. Consider from how partial a quarter your information came. My performance is mediocre to the last degree. You, Miss Woodhouse, I well know, play delightfully. I assure you, it has been the greatest satisfaction, comfort, and delight to me to hear what a musical society I am got into. I absolutely cannot do without music. It is a necessary of life to me. I could not give up a musical society. I honestly said as much to Mr. E. when he was speaking of my future home and expressing his fears lest my retirement from familiar society should be disagreeable. I had no fear of retirement. Blessed with so many resources within myself, the world was not necessary to me. I could do very well without it. To those who had no resources, it was a different thing, but my resources made me quite independent. And as to smaller-sized rooms than I had been used to, I really could not give it a thought. But, said I, to be quite honest, I do not think I can live without something of a musical society. Without music, life would be a blank to me. I hope we shall have many sweet little concerts together. I think, Miss Woodhouse, you and I must establish a musical club and have regular weekly meetings at your house or ours. Will not it be a good plan?
Tell me, Mrs. Elton, have you visited Randalls yet?
Oh, yes. We have indeed found them both at home, and very pleasant people they seem to be. I like them extremely. Mr. Weston seems an excellent creature, quite a first-rate favourite with me already, I assure you. And she appears so truly good. There is something so motherly and kind-hearted about her, that it wins upon one directly. She was your governess, I think.
Having understood as much, I was rather astonished to find her so very ladylike. But she is really quite the gentlewoman.
Mrs. Weston's manners were always particularly good. Their propriety and elegance would make them the safest model for any young woman.
And who do you think came in while we were there? Knightley. Knightley himself. Was not it lucky? I had never seen him before, and of course, as so particular a friend of Mr. E's, I had a great curiosity. My friend Knightley had been so often mentioned that I was really impatient to see him. And I must do my caro sposo the justice to say that he need not be ashamed of his friend. Knightley is quite the gentleman. I like him very much. Decidedly, I think, a very gentlemanlike man.
Happily, it was now time to be gone. They were off, and Emma could breathe. Insufferable woman, was her immediate thought. Worse than I had supposed. Absolutely insufferable. Knightley. I could not have believed it. Never seen him in her life before, and call him Knightley, and discover that he is a gentleman. A little upstart, vulgar being with her Mr. E and her caro sposo and her resources and all her airs of pert pretension and underbred finery. Actually, to discover that Mr. Knightley is a gentleman. I doubt whether he will return the compliment and discover her to be a lady. And to propose that she and I should unite to form a musical club, one would fancy we were bosom friends. And Mrs. Weston, astonished that the person who had brought me up should be a gentlewoman. Worse and worse. Oh, what would Frank Churchill say to her if he were here? How angry and how diverted he would be. Ah, there I am, thinking of him directly, always the first person to be thought of. How I catch myself out. All this ran so glibly through her thoughts that by the time her father had arranged himself after the bustle of the Eltons' departure and was ready to speak, she was very tolerably capable of attending.
Well, my dear, considering we never saw her before, she seems a very pretty sort of young lady, and I dare say she was very much pleased with you. She seems a very obliging young lady, and no doubt will make him a very good wife. I ought to have visited them before. Not to wait upon a bride is very remiss. Oh, it shows what a sad invalid I am. But I do not like the corner into Vicarage Lane.
I dare say your apologies were accepted, sir. Mr. Elton knows you.
Yes, but a young lady, a bride. I ought to have paid my respects to her if possible. It was being very deficient.
But my dear papa, you are no friend to matrimony. And therefore, why should you be so anxious to pay your respects to a bride? It ought to be no recommendation to you. It is encouraging people to marry if you make so much of them.
No, my dear, I never encouraged anybody to marry. But I would always wish to pay every proper attention to a lady. And a bride, especially, is never to be neglected.
Well, Papa, if this is not encouragement to marry, I do not know what is. And I should never have expected you to be lending your sanction to such vanity baits for poor young ladies.
My dear, you do not understand me. This is a matter of mere common politeness and good breeding. It has nothing to do with any encouragement to people to marry.
Emma had done. Her father was growing nervous and could not understand her. Her mind returned to Mrs. Elton's offences, and long, very long, did they occupy her. In the weeks that followed, Emma was not required by any subsequent discovery to retract her ill opinion of Mrs. Elton. Her observation had been pretty correct. Such as Mrs. Elton appeared to her on this second interview, such she appeared whenever they met again. Self-important, presuming, familiar, ignorant and ill-bred. She had a little beauty and a little accomplishment, but so little judgment that she thought herself coming with superior knowledge of the world to enliven and improve a country neighbourhood. There was no reason to suppose Mr. Elton thought at all differently from his wife. He seemed not merely happy with her, but proud. He had the air of congratulating himself on having brought such a woman to Highbury, as not even Miss Woodhouse could equal. To Harriet, her manners, and Mr. Elton's, were sneering and negligent. Emma hoped it must rapidly work Harriet's cure. But the sensations which could prompt such behaviour sunk them both very much. There must be someone, however, to whom Mrs. Elton could give her not inconsiderable energies and attention. It was Jane Fairfax, whom she took a great fancy to from the first. And she was not satisfied with expressing a natural and reasonable admiration, but without solicitation or plea or privilege, she must be wanting to assist and befriend her. It was after about the third time of their meeting that Emma heard all Mrs. Elton's knight-errantry on the subject. Their few turns about the shrubbery seemed to Emma to be taking much longer than usual.
Jane Fairfax is absolutely charming, Miss Woodhouse. I quite rave about Jane Fairfax. A sweet, interesting creature, so mild and ladylike, and with such talents. I do not scruple to say that she plays extremely well. You will laugh at my warmth, but upon my word, I talk of nothing but Jane Fairfax. And her situation is so calculated to affect one. Miss Woodhouse, we must exert ourselves and endeavour to do something for her. We must bring her forward. Such talent as hers must not be suffered to remain unknown.
I cannot think there is any danger of it. And when you are better acquainted with Miss Fairfax's situation and understand what her home has been with Colonel and Mrs. Campbell, I have no idea that you will suppose her talents can be unknown.
Oh! But, dear Miss Woodhouse, she is now in such retirement, such obscurity, so thrown away. Whatever advantages she may have enjoyed with the Campbells are so palpably at an end. And I think she feels it. I am sure she does. She's very timid and silent. One can see that she feels the want of encouragement. I like her the better for it. I must confess, it is a recommendation to me. I am a great advocate for timidity. In those who are at all inferior, it is extremely prepossessing. Oh, I assure you, Jane Fairfax is a very delightful character and interests me more than I can express.
You appear to feel a great deal, but I am not aware how you or any of Miss Fairfax's acquaintance here, any of those who have known her longer than yourself, can show her any other attention.
My dear Miss Woodhouse, a vast deal may be done by those who dare to act. You and I need not be afraid. If we set the example, many will follow it as far as they can, though all have not our situations. We have carriages to fetch and convey her home, and we live in a style which could not make the addition of Jane Fairfax at any time the least inconvenient. I shall certainly have her very often at my house, shall introduce her wherever I can, shall have musical parties to draw out her talents, and shall be constantly on the watch for an eligible situation. My acquaintance is so very extensive that I have little doubt of hearing of something to suit her shortly. I shall introduce her, of course, very particularly to my brother and sister when they come to us. I shall have her very often indeed while they are with me, and I dare say we shall sometimes find a seat for her in the barouche landau in some of her exploring parties.
Poor Jane Fairfax, thought Emma. You have not deserved this. You may have done wrong with regard to Mr. Dixon, but this is a punishment beyond what you can have merited. The kindness and protection of Mrs. Elton, oh, Jane Fairfax and Jane Fairfax, heavens! Let me not suppose that she dares go about Emma Woodhousing me. Emma had not to listen to such paradings again, to any so exclusively addressed to herself, so disgustingly decorated with a dear Miss Woodhouse. Mrs. Elton's feelings altered towards Emma. Offended, probably, by the little encouragement which her proposals of intimacy met with, she drew back in her turn and gradually became much more cold and distant. Emma was left in peace. Mrs. Elton's attentions to Jane Fairfax did not waver. Emma looked on with some surprise that Jane Fairfax should accept those attentions and tolerate Mrs. Elton as she seemed to do. She heard of her walking with the Eltons, sitting with the Eltons, spending a day with the Eltons. This was astonishing. Jane had come to Highbury, professedly, for 3 months, but now the Campbells had promised their daughter to stay at least till midsummer, and fresh invitations had arrived for her to join them there. According to Miss Bates, it all came from her. Mrs. Dixon had written most pressingly, but still she had declined it. She must have some motive more powerful than appears for refusing this invitation, was Emma's conclusion. She is not to be with the Dixons. But why must she consent to be with the Eltons? Here is quite a separate puzzle. It was during a visit from Mr. Knightley and Mrs. Weston that Emma could speak her wonder aloud on the puzzle. Mrs. Weston spoke first.
We cannot suppose that Miss Fairfax has any great enjoyment at the vicarage, my dear Emma. But it is better than being always at home. Her aunt is a good creature, but as a constant companion must be very tiresome. I should not wonder if Miss Fairfax has been drawn on beyond her own inclination by her aunt's eagerness in accepting Mrs. Elton's civilities for her. Poor Miss Bates may very likely have committed her niece and hurried her into a greater appearance of intimacy than her own good sense would have dictated, in spite of the very natural wish of a little change.
Another thing must be taken into consideration, too. You may be sure that Miss Fairfax awes Mrs. Elton. By her superiority, both of mind and manner, such a woman as Jane Fairfax probably never fell in Mrs. Elton's way before, and no degree of vanity can prevent her acknowledging her own comparative littleness in action, if not in consciousness.
I know how highly you think of Jane Fairfax.
Yes, anybody may know how highly I think of her.
And yet, perhaps you may hardly be aware yourself how highly it is. The extent of your admiration may take you by surprise some day or other.
Oh, are you there? But you are miserably behindhand. Mr. Cole gave me a hint of it 6 weeks ago. That will never be, however, I can assure you. Miss Fairfax, I dare say, would not have me if I were to ask her, and I am very sure I shall never ask her.
You are not vain, Mr. Knightley. I will say that for you.
So, you've been settling that I should marry Jane Fairfax?
No, indeed, I have not. You have scolded me too much for matchmaking for me to presume to take such a liberty with you. Upon my word, I have not the smallest wish for your marrying Jane Fairfax or Jane anybody. You would not come in and sit with us in this comfortable way if you were married.
No, Emma, I do not think the extent of my admiration for her will ever take me by surprise. I never had a thought of her in that way, I assure you. Jane Fairfax is a very charming young woman, but not even Jane Fairfax is perfect. She has a fault. She has not the open temper which a man would wish for in a wife.
Well, I quite agree. But as to her settling with the Eltons, Mrs. Weston, your argument weighs most with me. I can much more readily see the temptation of getting away from Miss Bates than I can believe in the triumph of Miss Fairfax's mind over Mrs. Elton. I have no faith in Mrs. Elton's acknowledging herself the inferior in thought, word, or deed.
But we must not forget that Jane receives attentions from Mrs. Elton which nobody else pays her, Emma. In truth, none of us can read Jane Fairfax clearly. She's reserved, more reserved, I think, than she used to be. And I love an open temper. She has feeling. I do not accuse her of want of feeling. Her sensibilities, I suspect, are strong, and her temper excellent in its power of forbearance, patience, self-control, but it wants openness. No, till Cole alluded to my supposed attachment, it had never entered my head. I saw Jane Fairfax and conversed with her with admiration and pleasure always, but with no thought beyond. Well, ladies, you must excuse me. I have business in Highbury. Good morning, Emma.
Good morning, Mr. Knightley.
Mrs. Weston.
Goodbye, Mr. Knightley. Well, Mrs. Weston, what do you say now to Mr. Knightley's marrying Jane Fairfax?
Why, really, dear Emma, I say that he is so very much occupied by the idea of not being in love with her that I should not wonder if it were to end in his being so at last.
Everybody in and about Highbury who had ever visited Mr. Elton was disposed to pay him attention on his marriage. Dinner parties and evening parties were made for him and his lady, and invitations flowed in so fast that she had soon the pleasure of apprehending, and often communicating, that they were never to have a disengaged day. No invitation came amiss to her. Her bath habits made evening parties perfectly natural to her, and Maple Grove had given her a taste for dinners. Though she was a little shocked at the want of two drawing rooms, at the poor attempt at rout cakes, and there being no ice in the Highbury card parties. Mrs. Bates, Mrs. Perry, Mrs. Goddard and others were a good deal behindhand in knowledge of the world, but she would soon show them how everything ought to be arranged. In the course of the spring, she must return their civilities by one very superior party. Emma, in the meanwhile, could not be satisfied without a dinner at Hartfield for the Eltons. They must not do less than others, or she should be exposed to odious suspicions and imagined capable of pitiful resentment. A dinner there must be. After Emma had talked about it for 10 minutes, Mr. Woodhouse felt no unwillingness. The persons to be invited required little thought. Besides the Eltons, it must be the Westons and Mr. Knightley, and poor little Harriet must be asked to make the 8th. But this invitation was not given with equal satisfaction, and Emma was particularly pleased by Harriet's begging to be allowed to decline it, for she was not yet quite able to see him and his charming, happy wife together without feeling uncomfortable. Emma was delighted with the fortitude of her little friend, for fortitude she knew it was in her to give up being in company and stay at home, and she could now invite the very person whom she really wanted to make the 8th, Jane Fairfax. Mr. Knightley's words dwelt with her. He had said that Jane Fairfax received attentions from Mrs. Elton which nobody else paid her. "I ought to have been more her friend," thought Emma. "She will never like me now. I have neglected her too long. But I will show her greater attention than I have done." Every invitation was successful, and Mr. John Knightley would be visiting, so would join his brother. There was for a short time the prospect of 9 guests to be at dinner instead of 8, which was most vexing to Mr. Woodhouse, who would only ever consider 8 the perfect number of guests. All was resolved, however, when Mr. Weston was unexpectedly summoned to town and must be absent on the very day. He might be able to join them in the evening, but certainly not to dinner. Mr. Woodhouse was at ease once more. The day came, the party were punctually assembled, and Mr. John Knightley seemed early to devote himself to the business of being agreeable. Instead of drawing his brother off to the window while they waited for dinner, he was talking to Miss Fairfax. Mrs. Elton, as elegant as lace and pearls could make her, he looked at in silence, wanting only to observe enough for Isabella's information. But Miss Fairfax was an old acquaintance and a quiet girl, and he could talk to her. He had met her before breakfast, as he was returning from a walk with his little boys, when it had been just beginning to rain. It was natural to have some civil hopes on the subject.
"I hope you did not venture far, Miss Fairfax, this morning, or I am sure you must have been wet. We scarcely got home in time."
"I only went to the post office and reached home before the rain was much. It is my daily errand. I always fetch the letters when I am here. A walk before breakfast does me good."
"Not a walk in the rain, I should imagine."
"No, but it did not absolutely rain when I set out."
"That is to say, you chose to have your walk, for you were not 6 yards from your own door when I had the pleasure of meeting you. And Henry and John had seen more drops than they could count long before. But the post office has a great charm at one period of our lives. When you have lived to my age, you will begin to think letters are never worth going through the rain for."
"I can easily believe that letters are very little to you, much less than to me. But it is not your being 10 years older than myself which makes the difference. It is not age, but situation. You have everybody dearest to you always at hand. I probably never shall again. And therefore, till I have outlived all my affections, a post office, I think, must always have power to draw me out, in worse weather than today."
"When I talked of your being altered by time, by the progress of years, I meant to imply the change of situation which time usually brings. I consider one as including the other.
As an old friend, you will allow me to hope, Miss Fairfax, that 10 years hence you may have as many concentrated objects as I have.
Thank you.
Her manner seemed meant to laugh it off, but a blush, a quivering lip, a tear in the eye showed that it was felt beyond a laugh. Her attention was now claimed by Mr. Woodhouse, who, making the circle of his guests and paying his particular compliments to the ladies, was ending with her.
I'm very sorry to hear, Miss Fairfax, of your being out this morning in the rain. Young ladies are delicate plants. They should take care of their health and their complexion. My dear, did you change your stockings?
Yes, sir, I did indeed. And I am very much obliged by your kind solicitude about me.
My dear Miss Fairfax, young ladies are very sure to be cared for. I hope your good grandmama and aunt are well. They are some of my very old friends. I wish my health allowed me to be a better neighbour. You do us a great honour visiting Hartfield today, I am sure.
The honour is mine, Mr. Woodhouse, I assure you.
I must speak with Jane.
Well, my dear, Jane, here my comes dear. Mrs. Elton Jane. Seeking your attention. Will you excuse me? I am in need of sitting down for a while.
My dear Jane, what is this I hear? Going to the post office in the rain? This must not be, I assure you. You sad girl. How could you do such a thing? It is a sign I was not there to take care of you.
Please do not be alarmed, Mrs. Yes. Elton. I have not caught cold.
Oh, do not tell me. You really are a very sad girl and do not know how to take care of yourself. To the post office, indeed. Mrs. Weston, did you ever hear the like? You and I must positively exert our authority.
Miss Fairfax, I do think you must not run such risks, especially as you have been liable to severe colds. Better wait an hour.